Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Professor Emma Teeling of UCD tells us how bats could help us in the fight against the coronavirus. Terry Flanagan introduces us to Ireland's newest species of mayfly. And we hear from the County Louth woman who claims she was attacked by a buzzard.
The sun was starting to go down, it was just really nice and starting to cool, and I said, right, I'll get out for a nice 12-13 kilometre walk from Cullen out to the Kells Road. I was, after turning down the lay-by from the lay-by cross and coming into a kind of a woodland type area where there's trees either side of the road, and the next thing I felt this or a merciful bang to my head, and I looked up and all I could see was this big massive humongous bird with his wings outstretched and his claws, talons, whatever you want to call them, coming down towards me.
I don't know about you, but I wouldn't fancy being attacked by a buzzard. They're a very large bird. You can text 51551 or you can email us now about anything at all to mooney@rte.ie. In the studio today, we've got Aina Nealana. Aina, you're very welcome to the programme today. Looking like the lady in red.
Well, suppose I am a lady in red.
If only Krista Berg was here to see
you. I'm not a lady in red. I'm a woman in red.
Well, you're the lady in red and you're the little polka dot bikini at the same time. You have a polka dot number
under
your red
frock. I'm a woman in a red frock, anything else.
Nylan, your red Guna is looking gorgeous too. Your Guna Darragh.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't know we were supposed to dress up today. But.
Nylan, I'm glad you're here today because I want you to have a listen to this sound. Can I have a listen to this bird sound, please, if you would? Please not, because I know you know what it is. Mm-hmm. Okay, Nylan, you know what that is?
It is. It's a nuthatch.
It's a nuthatch. Well, we got a card from Barry O'Donovan, who's in County Kerry. He says, "Dear Derek and team," he said, recently on the radio programme Sunday Miscellany, a contestant, I think he means a contributor, wrote of her childhood memories, early morning boating on the River Shannon with her father and he identifying the different sounds of birds they encountered. One was a kingfisher and the other was this bird that we were listening to a moment ago. You'd hear it again. That bird there, a nuthatch. "What is a nuthatch?" he asks. "Is it an older name for some bird that has fallen out of use? Yours sincerely, Barry O'Donovan." I thought to myself, a nuthatch in Ireland? I don't think we have any nuthatch in Ireland. But the person to ask is Niall Hatch.
Yeah, my namesake. Absolutely. The nuthatch, as it happens, is one of my favourite birds of all time. I love them. So I'm particularly upset that we don't have them in Ireland. So the contributor there in the programme must have been mistaken or must have been misinformed, because certainly there's never been a confirmed, even a single confirmed record of a nuthatch here in Ireland. They are an extremely common bird just across the water in Britain, and they range all the way across Britain and the whole of Europe, right across as far east as Japan. So they're a very widespread bird, just not present here in Ireland at all.
Backways tree creepers. That's right.
Well, you better explain that now.
Well, what they do is, you know, a tree creeper is a little brown mouse-like bird, creeps up a tree trunk. Another bird that does that is the woodpecker, the great spotted woodpecker we do have in Ireland now. The nuthatch famously goes down the tree. They can go up them as well, but they'll go down head first. And no other bird does that. So the nuthatch is quite a widespread family. There are many different species. There are lots of them in Asia.
Before you move on from that, so the tree creeper starts at the base.
Starts at the base. And
then goes up. Does it go up clockwise or anti-clockwise, or does it matter?
It doesn't really matter.
It's a zigzag pattern.
What they'll always do is, if threats are coming, they'll always put the tree between them and the potential predator. So they're hard to see because they'll creep around the tree trunk. But they're always going up, and then they get to the top of the tree and then they fly down to the base of the next one and start going up.
And start again. But the nuthatch flies to the top.
Yeah, but they're picking out the insects and they're seeing them on the way up. So when you're coming down, you get a different view and different insects.
Yeah, and they're gorgeous birds. They're sort of a lovely sort of greyish blue above. They have a sort of a little black stripe through the eye, and they have a lovely peachy pinkish kind of wash on the chest, pink, peachy orange kind of colour. Really, really lovely bird, a little short tail. And they're very widespread all across Europe and Asia. There are several different species in North America. You find many different species in Asia as well. There's even a unique species found on the island of Corsica, another one in Algeria, endemic just to those tiny regions. But the main species, the European or the Eurasian nuthatch, is widespread everywhere except in Ireland.
Why is it not in Ireland?
nobody can say for certain, but it's probably a result of the glaciation and the fact that Ireland was obviously covered mostly in glaciers, and we became an island roughly 10,000 years ago or so. And what happened was some species were able to get across the land bridge that still connected us to Britain, and some weren't. So it seems the tree creeper was one that did manage to get across, but the nuthatch wasn't. And one thing about nuthatches is they're very reluctant to fly across water. They don't like to do that. So that's, you know, some birds could have easily flown across into Ireland. They could see Ireland from Wales, for example. It seems that the great spotted woodpecker did that, but nuthatches never have. It's just too far. They don't like to cross water.
But your contributor, the Barry we sent in the note, he didn't send in a recording of the sound that he heard. So he might have heard.
No, and we have no dates or time, so we couldn't even find the actual programme, the Sunday Miscellany. Yeah. No, it was Barry had heard Sunday Miscellany, and one of the contributors to Sunday Miscellany had said they'd heard a nuthatch.
Oh, yes.
But we can't even find that because we don't know what date it was, what year it was. There's no date on the card. It just appeared. I wonder what somebody's trying to test us. It could be a test, Niall. It could be a test. Luckily, we all spotted it.
No, well, on the other hand, is there a bird in Ireland
that sounds like a nuthatch?
No. We don't know what this bird sounded like. The sound, we know what the sound of a nuthatch is. We don't know what the sound of this person who was the contributor to Sunday Miscellany heard. But what we want to know is there a bird that does occur in Ireland that people call the nuthatch? Even though it's not a nuthatch.
Not that I've come across. No.
Not that I have come across. I mean, we call, for example, the heron a crane.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe there's some other yoke that people call a nuthatch.
No.
I don't know. And you
not
don't
to
know,
my knowledge, no.
Maybe there is some common bird like a wren or some other thing that people call a nuthatch.
People think, yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to hear it one more time. Let's hear it one more time. This is the nuthatch, but it does not occur in Ireland. Only on radio. So there you are, there's your nuthatch. Now, we've often talked about herons on the programme. Their grey plumage and statuesque appearance make them unmistakable. Aina's just mentioned there. And they're found all year round in Ireland. The grey heron provided the inspiration for a magnificent public art installation in Cove in County Cork, which was funded and planned by Cork Tidy Towns. Or is it Cove Tidy Towns? I think it's Cove Tidy Towns. But to the absolute horror and disbelief of local people on Wednesday, after being in situ for just over a week, one of the herons was stolen. So the artist who was responsible for the installation is Emma Jane Rushworth, and she's with us in studio now, and she's a specialist in wire garden sculpture, and she's based out in Greystones in County Wicklow. So you're very welcome to the programme. So tell us about your work of art.
Oh, thanks.
Describe it first of all.
Thank you. Well, what it was inspired by the Kilskinny marshes. So the idea was to give a wildlife scene. So it had two herons, lots of bulrushes and reeds in a circular display on the only roundabout in Cove, leading down to the wildlife marshes, and three flying birds. So it got great response when it went up a week ago, and everybody became very excited and very immediately identified with it, and were very proud of it.
And the three flying birds, were they all heron?
No, there was two herons and then three sort of Arctic terns.
Three sort of Arctic terns.
Yes, because all my work is sort of, you know, I think wildlife is absolutely amazing, and it's all inspired by wildlife, but mm-hmm. They each have their own little character when they come out.
So why did you choose the heron and the Arctic tern? Did somebody give you that brief, or you just
decided
and off you go?
Yeah, I just felt that was right. Herons are very statuesque, like you say, and very beautiful. And I have done quite a few herons. And I just felt with the roundabout, and it's on the top of a hill and it's got lots of sky, that, you know, it would be also beautiful to see the flying birds because of the concept.
But they're wire sculpture now. Explain, what do they look like exactly?
Okay, so they're firm. I basically weave the wire into almost a solid form. So wire is a wonderful medium to work with. It's very free, but it does end up as quite a solid...
You brought one in with you, brought a hair in with you, and it's really beautiful, I have to say, and very solid looking. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, the wire is like a spider's web all over it, like a mesh,
yes,
if you like.
Yes.
So you've woven it so you can see through it, in a sense, because it's all woven.
Yes.
But it's definitely the shape of the hair and the ears and the whole lot. And it's like as if nearly he's wearing a coat of mail or something.
Yes, it is. Yeah. A little, yeah. I think now, you know, that I've got so rhythmic with my weaving that, you know,
speak into the microphone there, please. I'm sorry, we were looking away off it. But tell me, so somebody has stolen one of the herons.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
What exactly happened? When did you find out?
I found out on Thursday evening. So I think it was Friday morning I found out. So it was stolen on Wednesday, late in the night time. So somebody would have had to go out of their way to
nick it.
Yes, with some angle grinders and a truck, really, a van, because it wouldn't have fit into a the boot of a regular car.
I don't want to be rude or crude, but is it a valuable piece?
Only to the tidy towns. You know, it's got no resale value. It's so distinctive. There, like I said, I've only made seven herons, of which these two are two of the seven.
So somebody tries to flog it. You know, if anybody comes knocking on your door saying, would you like to buy a piece of garden ornament? Don't.
No, that's
right. Or do
right.
And then give it back to us.
Yeah, well, that's right. It's that's one of the reasons why the tidy towns are really pushing to try and recover their heron. And they've started off this hashtag bring back our bird campaign. And they've got a great community spirit down there. And everybody's sort of on the lookout, I'm sure, for the piece.
Were you very upset when you heard it was taken?
I couldn't believe it. I think the first time I was like, I can't believe it, because they were so proud of it. But...
And it's on a roundabout, right in the middle of cars driving around.
Yes.
So, I mean, it was a very public place.
Yeah, very public place. And they weigh a fair bit, you know, and they're very big wingspan.
I mean, the pictures of it would look beautiful. It was a whole account of it in the Irish Times yesterday, and they had a photograph of it all with the wings on display, and it did look magnificent.
What metal is it made out of?
We weld a frame, so it's made out of a good steel frame, and then steel, and then finally on the top there's a bronze weaving. So it's a matter of layers and layers of weaving to create the final piece.
And you mentioned that someone probably had to get an angle grinder or something like that.
In the middle of the night, yes.
So it wasn't just a grab it and run type thing.
No.
It would have taken quite an operation to do.
Yeah. They would have had to either use that or a very large pair of industrial bolt cutters to get it off.
It's terrible.
Well, it's going to be a bit perhaps like the Little Mermaid in Denmark and Copenhagen. I remember when I was a kid, every summer you would hear the Little Mermaid had lost her head again.
Yes.
And then it would reappear, but they'd get so much publicity out of it that it was nearly great for the city that the Little Mermaid had lost her head again. I'm not suggesting that. But however, it is good for the tidy towns in the sense that we're now paying attention to it, and now they're being highlighted, and Cove has been highlighted, which is very important. And we do a lot in Cove, particularly in Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve,
yes,
which is where we broadcast our dawn chorus from.
Yes.
And in fact, we've just received a lovely picture in of three ducks on a wall at Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove from Rosarie Ryan, which she took this morning, which we'll try and put up on the website. And it's two males and a female just on the wall. A lovely picture, just looking out on the marsh.
See the birds doing bird watching instead of humans.
Exactly. Well, we hope you get it back.
Yeah, so do we. And everybody in Cove does as well. They're very vigilant, and I believe we'll find it.
Okay, well, if anybody happens to come across it, or if you are listening now and you took it, why don't you just give it back? You can always send an email to mooney@rte.ie and we'll make sure that it gets back to the right people.
It could be left somewhere and go away.
Well, it could be put back where it was taken from, perhaps.
Yes, all ready to weld it back together and put it back in its rightful place.
Well, thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you very much
appreciated, Emma. You can email mooney@rte.ie or text 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Doesn't this sound remind you of two women gossiping over a garden fence? Or the late Frankie Hard? Well, back in April we broadcast a documentary about the animal that's making this sound. It is the eider duck. Now, the eider duck, we're all familiar with the name eider because we all think we've got eider down quilts. And I can tell you, you don't, because if you had, you'd be very wealthy indeed, because an eider down quilt can cost you anything up to €10,000 just for a double. Can you believe it? It's true. Go online, check them out. Type in eider duck quilt. How much in Ireland? See if anybody's selling them, first of all, and where you can get them and how much they cost. Anyway, I want to say hello to Tom and Linda, two old friends of mine, who, when we broadcast this programme first time around, called me to say they just loved the sound of the eider duck. So I hope they're enjoying it again. And you can enjoy it again tomorrow evening right here on RT Radio 1, because in our second chance slot, where we delve into the Mooney Goes Wild archive and bring out some gem, you'll get an opportunity to hear once again a documentary about the eider duck.
It's a lot of work to collect eiderdown or harvest eiderdown. You have to protect the eiderduck. And some farmers has to begin in mid-April to protect the eiderducks from the predators.
So how do they protect them from the predators?
They make some fences. Some of them make some fences. They make some bells, some noise.
So if you're making fences, you're keeping out the likes of foxes?
Foxes and minks.
But how can you protect the eggs from seagulls, for example?
It's very difficult to do it. We are allowed to kill the predators, and some farmers do.
And can I ask, were they ever eaten, the duck itself?
It happens because the eiderduck is a diver, and sometimes it happens to dive into fishermen's nets. And because it's protected and forbidden to eat, but people did not want to throw it away when it was diving in the net, so they brought it to land in a bag. And it was called not eiderduck, bag duck.
Bag duck.
Like in a bag.
Yeah.
Yeah, bag duck.
Wonderful sound and a beautiful bird. And quite a hardy duck it is too, when you consider where it breeds high up there in the Arctic. They are breeding around the coast of Ireland now, off the northwest coast and indeed off the coast of Skerries, but not in any great numbers, not big enough numbers to harvest the down and turn it into a business as they've done in Iceland. Iceland is the largest producer of eider down. Anyway, you can hear that documentary tomorrow evening right here on RT Radio 1 from 10 p.m. Now, you know I've been following the progress of the female mute swan and her six cygnets in Blessington Street Basin. We've told you all about them from their very first swim. Well, we have an update now, because in the very best tradition of news gathering, Terry Flanagan has sent us this report.
Yes, Derek, I'm here in Blessington Street Basin, and I'm just here at the lake, and the swans are on it. Now, we've been following these swans here for the last, nearly 10 weeks or so now. And I'm just looking at them and see the little stubby wings of the cygnets. And I know you were here during the week and there were six of them. And yes, thank God there's still six of them here. But I can't get over those little stubby wings. And they've become very independent lately too. I'm just looking at there. There's one that seems to be hanging back from the mother. But she doesn't seem to care that much. And of course, as we said, there is no daddy here in this particular family. There's just the mammy and the six young ones. And the other thing too are the fountains. There's three fountains working here now. I always remember years ago, is it four? Actually, there are four fountains I can see here now that are working. Years ago, there was only one fountain, this large fountain that's in front of me. But anyway, getting back to the swans, Derek, the reason why I'm here is because during the week, we got a call from a lady who was here watching this family of swans swimming along in formation, the mammy and the six babies coming behind them. And each of them, every single one of them, had one leg out of the water, completely clear of the water, and lying or resting up on its back. And she was wondering, is this an unusual behaviour? Does this normally happen with swans? And to be honest, it's not a totally unusual behaviour. I've seen it myself. And why do they do it? Well, they could do it for a number of different reasons. I don't think there's any one particular reason. Maybe they just want to stretch their legs, because like you or I, you might want to just give that old leg a good stretch. Or it's a bit like to cross your legs. We humans like to cross our legs. Maybe this is the way in which they cross their legs. But I think really...
Crossing their legs, Terry, are you kidding me?
Yeah, don't you do it as well? We all cross our legs. But I think, to be honest, it has something to do with thermoregulation. In other words, heat regulation. So if it's a very, very cold day, maybe they keep the two legs in the water. Or maybe if it's a very, very warm day, what they might want to do is they might want to take one leg out of the water and dissipate this heat. I know, for instance, flamingos do that. I think that's the most plausible explanation. But then again, you've often seen birds, Derek, I'm sure, like herons, standing in water on one leg and wondering why do they do that. It's a similar kind of behaviour. And I think that they're trying to cast a shadow on the water so that they look like a tree or a bush. So that fish in the water think, OK, let's go in here for a bit of shade. And they go in for a bit of shade and all of a sudden, bang, the heron nabs them.
Yeah, but they wouldn't need to stand on one leg to do that, Terry.
No, but I think birds as well, they're much more comfortable about standing on one leg. So anyway, I don't think there's any one particular reason as to why they would do that. But it is a common occurrence. Yes, it does happen.
Anyway, it's something for you to look out for if you find yourself in or around Blessington Street Basin or anywhere. You'll see some swans. Look out for that leg over its back. Now, Terry, you were also doing a story for us about mayfly on the River Dodder.
Yes, I was. I was up near the dropping well. I'm sure you know that part of the Dodder. And I was with Dr. Hugh Feely. Now, Hugh works with the EPA. That's the Environmental Protection Agency. And Hugh has recently discovered a new species of mayfly.
Oh, I see.
So when we thought there were only 33 species of mayfly in Ireland, we now know, because it has been recently confirmed, that there are 34 species. And his findings will be published in the coming weeks.
So we're here on the Dodder River in the heart of Dublin City. You see people walking by with their dogs, cycling by. But really, this is a very important ecosystem.
And not just is it an important ecosystem, but it's extremely important because it's here that you found a new species of mayfly.
Yes, we found a new species called Betis atlanticus. It was discovered originally in Madeira back in the early 2000s. But last year, we confirmed its presence in Ireland for the first time.
And what was that feeling like? You know, you pick up this mayfly, you look at it and say, this looks a little bit different. What did you do?
Yeah, it was a bit different. You bring it back to the lab. I had to put it under a microscope and look at a few features. And I must admit, I got quite excited and I sent it to a friend of mine in Scotland who confirmed the finding.
How long did that take?
About 30 minutes. But we then, I had several rivers across the country and we started to expand what we were looking for and we discovered it. Usually you'd want to confirm it in more than one location.
So this actual species has been in a number of rivers around Ireland and no one has ever come across it?
It's probably in all rivers across Ireland. It's called a cryptic species, and what that means is it's very, very similar to another species that's very common in Ireland called Betis rhodani. And it was only through genetic work that people discovered that the two were different. And when we started to look for it, suddenly it started appearing.
Now, there were 33 species before this, and this is now a 34th species. But it's been years and years and years since the last one was discovered. That's an incredible find.
Yeah, well, technology is always advancing. You have to imagine microscopes are getting better, technologies around genetic work is getting better. So back in the 50s and 60s, they discovered all these species, and even earlier, back in Ireland in the late 1800s. But in reality, we don't actually know how many species are out there. There are probably more to be found.
Now, unfortunately, you don't get to name this species because it has already been named. But would you get a Hibernicus or anything at the end of it, no?
No, you do get species that can have a very peculiar life cycle or behaviour, and then you could name them. But it's very rare that a brand new species is found, especially in Ireland, where we don't really have the expertise or the resources.
So it will stay as Betis atlanticus and not Betis atlanticus felicus.
No, it would be Betis atlanticus, yeah. Which in itself is a nice name considering our position on the Atlantic.
That was Terry Flanagan talking to Hugh Feely. Aina, you've got an email there?
Oh yeah, well I was just wondering before we go on to the email, he probably found the mayfly as a nymph in the water rather than flying around, because people say the mayflies only live for one day, but in actual fact they live as nymphs in the water for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that's presumably, he didn't say whether it was the flying mayfly or the nymph in the water, but generally in the rivers people are doing scoops, getting up the invertebrates that are in the bottom of the river. They're the ones that the dippers are hopping up and down feeding on, because they're feeding on the invertebrates. So that's possibly what it was. So well done to him. My email. Yes, dear Derek, one evening last week, as it was becoming dusk, I approached the city from Ranelagh and an animal came out and ran across the road in front of my car. I slowed up as I thought it was a young fox, and it ran into a garden on the opposite side of the road. But as I watched it running, it was the height of a medium-sized dog, but it was definitely cat-like. It was not a domestic cat. It looked like a wild cat. It was thin, and its tail was thin and long, and it ran through the garden, not creeping like a cat or a fox. It was not a nice-looking animal. It was scary-looking. Could it have been a wild cat?
Is there
such a thing? I wouldn't like to meet it head-on, says Pat Fitzpatrick.
Well, there are wild cats in Scotland, aren't there not?
There are wild cats all across Europe. They're quite widespread, but not...
But they sure ain't in Ranelagh, that's for sure. They aren't even in Ireland.
And one of the things that's very striking about wildcats, they look almost identical to a domestic tabby cat, except the wildcats have a very thick, bushy tail. And Pat here distinctly says that
it was thin and long. It was possibly a feral cat, a cat that doesn't belong to anybody and is hunting around.
Do cats belong to anybody, Aina?
Well, people belong to cats, I think. Is that what the people tell us? But if this cat is living in a house in Ranelagh where its owners have decamped perhaps to their holiday home and haven't come back, perhaps the poor creature is galloping around the place looking for somebody to feed it. And not a nice looking animal. I mean, that's beauty in the eye of the beholder. That's not fair. Does the animal think we look nice?
Well, do you like sloths? Do you like the look of sloths?
Well, I don't encounter them very much.
No, you wouldn't, Aina, but do you like the look of them?
Yeah, I think they're great. I'd love to see a sloth in real life.
You know?
Yeah,
I think they're very cute. Yeah, they're weird little hands. Yeah.
Very slow moving. Anyway, some of you may remember we spoke to William Hartson. He's author of a book called Sloths, A Celebration of the World's Most Maligned Mammal. He told me why he loved them so much.
I just fell in love with sloths, just absolutely at random.
Why?
I thought this is wonderful. This is the perfect lifestyle. You hang upside down, eating the leaves around you. You only move when either the leaves around you have run out and you need to go somewhere else, or to come down the tree once a week to poo and pee. And you disembowel anything that irritates you. This is the perfect lifestyle.
Imagine they only come down once a week to poo and pee. Otherwise, they just hang around up there.
And they're so slow moving that they even get like moss and algae growing on their fur to make them look green. They're so slow the plants grow on them.
And they move less than half the length of a soccer pitch every day. I mean, that is slow. Anyway, he's written this fabulous book. That was a couple of years ago when we interviewed him, but we discovered some of the books in the press upstairs and we were doing a bit of a clean out the other day and we thought, well, why should they be up there when our listeners might enjoy reading them? So we thought it might be nice to give a couple of these copies away. So all you got to do is text with the correct answer to 51551. Here is the question. While sloths do spend some time on the ground and are surprisingly good swimmers, approximately what percentage of their lives do they spend hanging upside down? Is it A, 30%, B, 60%, or C, 90%? So you just text A to 51551 with your name, obviously, or B to 51551, or C to 51551. So A, is it 30%? Is it 60%? Or is it 90%? Okay, have you got that? Right, we'll be back after this break.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Email mooney@rte.ie.
Now, I want you to have a listen to something. If you're a regular listener to the programme, you may already know what it is. There it is. Listen out. Listen out for the clicks. The sound of bats echolocating at night, looking for food. As recorded on a bat detector, I'm told when you don't hear the sound when they stop, it's when they've caught an insect on the wing. Isn't nature just wonderful? And now scientists have discovered the genetic blueprints behind six of the world's bats, mapping their complete DNA for the first time. Now, the breakthrough offers fresh insights into their exceptional immunity, which protects them against deadly illnesses, including the coronavirus, and could, and I repeat, could provide clues on how to battle these diseases. Among the international team that carried out the research was Professor Emma Teeling of the UCD School of Biology and Environmental Science. Richard Collins spoke with her earlier.
Emma, I am totally at sea when it comes to this COVID and bats. On the one hand, bats are said to be a source of this awful thing. And on the other hand, they're supposed to be great at dealing with viruses. How can they have it both ways?
It's a very interesting question that you've asked me, Richard. It's argued that bats have evolved this very unique immune system that allows them to tolerate a lot of viruses. Bats don't seem to suffer the same symptoms when they're infected with the virus like we do and like other mammals do. So the reason why they've argued that they're the cause is because the most similar virus that we've ever found that we know about was found in these bats. But also, potentially the reason why they can have such a high diversity of these viruses is because they've evolved mechanisms to tolerate and live with them. So the bats potentially were somewhere involved in the path that led to this COVID-19, but also they potentially hold novel ways to treat it.
Well, now, why would a virus aren't alive, but let us look at them as if they were. Now, if you were looking for a host species of which to grow and reproduce, the last ones you would go to would be the ones that are experts at expelling viruses. And they are, of course, the bats. How is it that the bats, the great killers, T cells and B cells and everything doing great work eliminating viruses, how is it that the virus should start in that particular type of animal?
Well, there's this arms race that happens all the time between pathogens and a host. And in the bats, they seem to evolve this very tolerant immune system. So when we looked, so we have just published these 6 bat genomes in Nature yesterday. It's a brilliant achievement. It's the first pilot study of BAT1K. And these are exquisite genomes. And I think I talked to you guys, Mooney Goes Wild, really when we started this project back in 2016. But we have this result. And again, the question was, well, all right, what are the bats doing to allow them to tolerate the viruses? And because a virus wants to exist in a tolerant host. So we looked initially at some of the bats' immune response. And when you look in the genome, and when you look at sometimes how these bat immune cells respond to viruses, what you'll see is that bats exquisite a very aggressive antiviral response first. And in the genome, you'll see this expansion of these APOBEC3 viral genes, for example. So they are able to mount a very aggressive antiviral response, and their antiviral immune response is always switched on in some species. Now, we can't have our antiviral immune response always switched on, because what it does is it triggers this really, really aggressive immune response to remove the virus, to neutralize this virus. But at the same time, your own immune response kills you. And so what the bats also have evolved in coincidence with this highly aggressive antiviral response is an equally aggressive anti-inflammatory response. So the bats, and you can again see this in the genome, you'll find that there's a whole suite of inflammatory genes that are missing in the bat genomes. And there's a whole range of selection and base pair changes in these anti-inflammatory genes. It's very different in bats. And what this means is that they have evolved the mechanism to be able to incapacitate them. And then also they have an equally aggressive anti-inflammatory response. And you can see this in the genome. What this means is that they have evolved this, I suppose, a Goldilocks immune response to be able to deal with viruses. This can push the virus into a bit of an arms race. So the virus has to change all of the time to try and evade the bat's immune response. The virus has to change all of the time to be able to get into some of the bat's cells. And so that just means that you should have a much higher diversity of viruses in bats. And you see that this is actually the case. We were also able to look at the fossilized viruses in the bat genome. Now, what does that mean? When you have an exquisite genome where you've sequenced in these really big, long pieces, you can find evidence of surviving past viral infections. Think about how a virus replicates. It's got to put its DNA or RNA into your molecular machinery, your genetic machinery. And that means that sometimes it leaves copy of itself in your DNA. And you can go and find these different copies. And we were able to do this. So you'd sequence the bat genome and you'd see bat, 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 virus, bat, 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 when you looked at the sequence, say if you're looking in a row. And working with this group in Oxford, we were able to take all of these viral inserts, we make phylogenetic trees and work out that in the past, bats have survived multiple different types of viruses. We found a brand new virus that was known only to ever infect birds. We found evidence of bats surviving it by this fossilized evidence in their genome. And bats have a much higher diversity of these integrated endogenized viruses. And again, this is evidence that they could survive these infections. So all of this points to the fact that bats and viruses are in these arms race the whole time. But every species is an arms race with viruses. It drives evolution, really. And that they have evolved mechanisms to be able to deal and tolerate this. And more than likely, this is why they can live with so many viruses.
So have you the prospect of genetically engineering us to be able to do some of these wonderful things that bats can do? Can you lift, cut and paste genes from bat DNA and put them into human DNA? Is that a practical prospect? Or are you just taking T cells or something and injecting those? Is this the approach you will take?
I'm going to take neither of those approaches because we don't need to do either of them. Looking at bats, they're not going to find a novel antibody solution. This is not a vaccine, but it is a treatment. And the idea is, can we treat, how do you treat individuals that are succumbing to a viral infection, for example, or any infection? And the idea is that, if you think about it right now, Luke O'Neill's been talking about this a lot. All right, some successful drugs in the COVID-19 fight. Is it Remdesivir? It's an antiviral. And then the idea of some type of an anti-inflammatory to fight against the IL-6 cytokine. Again, so when you look at how bats progress in terms of an infection, what you have to know is, and again, something that's been, that a lot of these, the doctors have been thinking about is, when do you give the antiviral? When then do you give the anti-inflammatory? What time points in the infection should you give these treatments? The bats have evolved this natural solution already. So if you study how infection progresses in bat cells in a lab, for example, and you can see, well, all right, they quickly mount this very, you know, there's a high levels of antivirals at this stage. And then at this time point in the infection, you bring in the anti-inflammatories to neutralize and stop and throttle that immune response. So by studying how it progresses in bats, we get a much better idea of what we can do. But then the other thing is that we were able to identify these orthologous genes. So the genes that we know are different in the bat immune system, we also have a version of these genes. And what we're very interested in is looking at the expression. So potentially you can give us drugs to knock out some of the genes that are causing this high inflammatory response and causes us to actually have these cytokine storms and makes the outcome of infection quite bad. Potentially we can go and look at what the bats have evolved, find the genes, find the bat pathways, and then mimic the expression of our genes to match that with drugs. We can do this.
You sound optimistic. You sound hopeful. Are you?
I'm really, really hopeful. There was this term that was used in Science magazine. It's called the wilding of immunology. And for a long time, because we didn't have the molecular tools, we weren't able to generate brilliant genomes. We weren't able to grow cells from different animals in the lab. With all the new technologies, we can now look to nature to try and find alternative and novel ways for us to be able to treat diseases. Treat cancer, potentially. Bats can do that too. We talked about that before. I actually think that what's happening is that right now there's a whole merger of different types of research areas together. And this is driven and really being highlighted because of the horror of this pandemic and the realization that as a species, we can't just keep on going around utilizing the environment the way we see fit, and that we're part of nature. And that not only are we part of nature, we've got to look to nature and look at the evolution of other species close to us or further away from us to be able to find answers. And that I think it's the merger of all these fields that now allows us come up with really novel solutions. We've got to think outside the box. We've got to think inside the bat. I've been always arguing this for a long time. And these genomes are the tools that can allow us to do it now. I mean, I was working with a lot of the viral hunters since the year 2002 because we knew about the different types of viruses that species can hold. But if you think about it, this pandemic, this zoonotic disease, a disease hopping from a different species into us somehow. We don't know how it got there, and we still have to work out that 40 to 70 years of really missing important data. You know, where did it come from? We can try and answer that question. Maybe we'll find the answer. Maybe we won't. Doesn't matter. COVID-19 is now a human disease. But the thing about it is, it's not the first time that a virus hopped out of a species into humans and caused a devastating effect. HIV, that's a zoonotic disease. The flu, that's a zoonotic disease. And there's potentially lots more out there. And so really what we have to do is we have to think of novel ways to treat this. And we also need to treat our environment and our interactions with our fellow species with a bit more respect, because we aren't that invincible.
It's been wonderful talking to you. It's lifted the spirits considerably. It seems to be a case that if we can't beat the viruses, we must join them and live with them. Would that be a good summation?
It would. We still need that vaccine. We've got to get that. The vaccine as well as the treatments. This is the way forward. Think of HIV. We still don't have a cure for HIV, but we can treat it. And looking at the bat is not to find the cure, it's to find the treatment. And that's how I see how our genomes can help in this fight.
We got to think outside the box and inside the bat, Aina.
Well, exactly. It just shows the importance of knowing about other species. And, you know, we destroy the rainforests, we make species extinct that we didn't even know existed. And yet, in all of these species, there's real things that can help us as a human species to actually survive these things. So another reason for saving our environment, for making sure that all of the things, just because somebody says, oh, what good is that? You might know what good it is today, but it'll be all, it's been around for longer than we have. Mm-hmm. So it's
the butterfly effect, you damage something here and across the other side of the world.
You know, they have been around much longer. We've only been around for 750,000 really years as humans, whereas they've been around for much longer. They must have been doing something right. And it, the story, the pattern is in their genes. I think it's fascinating.
It really is fascinating. I think there's a lot to, we have to learn there. And of course, this whole co-evolution between the bats and the virus, because it's not in a virus's interest to kill its host. It wants to keep the host alive long enough to spread itself. And it's interesting to see how the from what Emma was saying there about the bat genome has been accommodating that. And the virus in some cases has been lucky that the bats have been able to evolve to cope with it. It's helped the virus out. And it's really interesting to see it's sort of like a mutually beneficial arrangement between the two of them. I think it's really fascinating stuff.
Well, I'm delighted to see that Emma came back to us. 6 years ago she was telling us about this research, and now they've published some of their findings, so it is terrific. It really is.
Yeah, she's finding all kinds of things in bats. When she was talking to us before, she was saying how long lived a species they were, and how the telomeres at the end of their chromosomes weren't unraveling, like the shoelaces weren't unraveling, and that we could get hints about how to live longer from the fact of this. So
there's a lot to be learned from bats.
The whole answer to the whole world is bats. So people saying I don't like bats, get alive.
Email Mooney at rte.ie or text 51551.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Tons and tons of answers to our question for the Sloth book, and we'll be announcing the two winners in just a few moments. But first, Lorraine Young is from Cullen. And is it Cullen or Colin?
Cullen.
Cullen.
Called after the hazel tree on Cull. Okay. Cullen. It's pronounced Cullen.
In County Louth. And she was walking recently when she endured a most unexpected and unpleasant strike from the sky overhead.
The sun was starting to go down. It was just really nice and starting to cool. And I said, right, I'll get out for a nice 12, 13 kilometre walk. From Cullen out to the Kells Road, I was after turning down the lay-by from the lay-by cross and coming into a kind of a woodland type area where there's trees either side of the road. And the next thing I felt this merciful bang to my head, and I looked up and all I could see was this big, massive, humongous bird with his wings outstretched and his claws, talons, whatever you want to call them, coming down towards me. The colour, it was kind of a dark brownish kind of feathery bird. There was flecks through the board, through the feathers, kind of dark flecks. And I just started kind of shouting at it and flapping my hands that it wasn't going to latch on to me again. Obviously, it might have been scared or whatever, but it flew away again and perched on a branch. His fear didn't last too long because it started staring at me really aggressively. And I said to myself, this pecker's going to come at me again. So I kept walking along the road, but obviously kept an eye on the board and kept looking at it. And lo and behold, it did. It came at me again. And in total, it came at me four times.
What damage was done, Lorraine? Can you describe the injuries?
There was a couple of puncture wounds to the top of my head. Thankfully, they weren't deep. so they didn't need any stitches or anything like that, but they did need to be cleaned out. And I did need a tetanus the following day with my local GP. And then after that, I sustained headaches for about 5 or 6 days.
You described what happened on social media and you got a react.
A few people contacted me on Facebook to say that they were attacked by a bird.
Do you think it was by the same bird, Lorraine?
Well, it was the same area, so it might not be the same bird. There could be a few of them nesting there, but it came across as the same type of bird, so similar colouring that I have described. But from this bird attack, I have learned that there are a good few buzzards in Cullen on the Kells Road, and before this, they've never attacked humans, that the biggest thing they'd go for would be a rat or a small rabbit or something like that. It sounds that it's very out of character for this type of bird. I wasn't trying to make people afraid of the bird or be wary of animals in general or birds in general. I just wanted them to take a cautious approach while on the road.
So that's Lorraine's story. Niall Hatch, what is going on? A buzzard attacking a human?
Yes, it's been a very strange year this year in many respects. We never heard in Birdwatch Ireland of a buzzard ever doing this to a person before. And we know of at least 3 or 4 separate instances where this has happened. So the bird in Louth, there was another incident in Meath. There was a well-publicised one in Carlow and another one in South County Dublin as well. And what seems to have happened is that this is a territorial response from the buzzards. They're nesting close to the roads where people are jogging or walking or whatever. Normally they would nest well away from human beings. They're very wary of us and they want to avoid us like the plague. What happened, of course, was at the start of their nesting season, there weren't any humans around. The COVID-19 restrictions were in. People were limited to within 2 kilometres of their houses. And so there were no humans around. So these birds would nest quite close to the roads and the paths because they thought, well, it's safe. There's no people. Then all of a sudden, the restrictions are eased. People are out right at the time when the nestlings have hatched out of the eggs and the parents are feeling very vulnerable. And that's what's provoked this aggressive response. So it's connected to COVID-19. It's another thing we can blame on that wonderful pandemic. And hopefully if things return to normal next year, this shouldn't happen again. It's because of the absence of humans made the birds a bit too close to where humans would be.
And would both the male and the female be displaying this territorial behaviour?
Yes.
There wasn't just a male one.
No, you can't really tell. The male and female look identical, but I would say it could be both of them. And not every buzzard would do this. Even some buzzards would still be too frightened of people, but obviously a few of them were able to overcome that. It must be a very unpleasant experience. They're big
because
bird
the buzzard is the farmer's friend, and as she said, they feed on rats, they feed on small rabbits, things that are pests to farmers, in fact. So we shouldn't be cross with the buzzard, just keep out of their way.
Absolutely. They have no interest in harming humans other than when they see them as a threat to their chicks. So that was the case here. Otherwise, they give us a very wide berth. So hopefully it's just a one-off this year and won't occur again.
Well, a three-off, as you said. Three reports. Anyway, you heard a voice interviewing Lorraine. He describes himself as having a kind of medic reassuring voice, and he's in studio with us now, John Bell O'Reilly.
I think that was how you described it, Derek, during the interview there. And you asked a little earlier on about what percentage of slots' lives do they spend hanging upside down. What percentage of your life do you spend hanging upside down, Derek? Roughly.
Well, I don't have to do that anymore now. I'm really retired.
Slots spend an extraordinary 90%, which is something else. And this is achievable for slots, interestingly perhaps, as they can breed normally in this upside down position. How? Because their organs are attached to the rib cage and therefore don't press down on the lungs. So that's how they do it, apparently.
So why were we asking this question?
So the question, we were asking the question because we were giving away a couple of books of a very, very, very well presented book. And it is called Slots, A Celebration of the World's Most Misunderstood Mammal by William Hartson. And those two books will be going out to Joan Mahon, who is in Kilkenny, and also to Martina Gardner, who is down in Limerick.
Fantastic. Now, do you want to mention the website today, the photographs social media?
Speaking of elevated animals, a photograph we published of a herd of wild goats crossing a sea arch on the East Scheme Island in Roaring Water Bay, West Cork, by Beth Caddick, really appears to have stopped people in the tracks. It's had over 3,000 shares on our Twitter and Facebook. So if you want to see this magical shot for yourself, go and check that out on the Mooney Goes Wild Facebook and Twitter.
All right, John, thank you very much indeed. I don't know if I've got time to ask, but very quickly, Liam O'Keefe, who's in Skull in County Cork, he said that each day I watch gannets dive into the waters of the sound, some literally yards from my home, but I have never seen one surface with a fish in its bill, Niall Hatch.
Well, what they often do is they'll gobble that fish down before they surface or just as they come to the surface. So they have quite expandable throats. They're related to pelicans. So they can gulp things down quite a bit. So they're probably swallowing it before you see them do it.
So down they go, gobble the fish, come up, and they have it in their shopping bag, as it were, inside in their crop. And when they have enough of them there, they fly back to the nest and they puke them all up over the little babies.
And regurgitate them,
That's their dinner. Here's your dinner.
Anyway, Liam wrote into us. So you can write to Mooney at rte.ie. You can email Mooney at rte.ie or text 51551. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Eamon Lana and to Niall Hatch on sound. We had Gar Duffy. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher, and you heard him there, is John Bell O'Reilly. My producers today, Anna Leddy and Sheila O'Callaghan. And we'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Till next week, bye!
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.